Welcome to One Simple Question, the podcast that asks a basic, everyday question that then delves into the unique and decidedly non-basic answer. This week, I have a conversation with one of my college roommates, Malin Shaw. Malin is a doctor in Houston, Texas, and full disclosure, this episode is all about COVID-19. I'm sorry if you're sick of this topic, and we actually recorded it before the madness of Donald Trump getting the virus and the more extreme lockdowns across the world. That said, it's still a really important topic because I, like many of you, let my guard down about everything virus-related. And I think now we're all seeing the repercussions of that. I asked Malin to simply say how things are going, what we have to look forward to in 2021, and any advice. Oh, and just a heads up, I had just flown in from London to Chicago, so please disregard my tired tone. I have not been jet lagged since February. Hey Malin, it's Abhishek. This is still a good time to chat?
Yes, definitely.
Cool. Thanks for taking time today. I know you're really busy. Feels like forever since we caught up. How are you holding up? And for the folks who are listening, where are you holding up?
It's my pleasure. I'm located in Houston, Texas. It's in the USA. Well, I'll say 2020 has been quite stressful here. Initially, March, April, it was filled with quite some panic and major lockdowns. And initially, our strategy in Houston was, it worked, I think, because we were barely affected. But then when we started to open up maybe around May, at that time, there was so many arguments going on whether the decision was wise or even with hindsight, this can be still be up for debate. Regardless, we saw a major impact from COVID-19 in Houston. Approximately, I would say, late May to August. I think you can even consider that this is still part of that first peak, June through July, and because the cases were just slowly rising all the way from March onwards. Well, I guess to better understand the impact in Houston, I think it's probably important to give you some background information. Houston has probably one of the largest, if not the largest, medical center in the world. We have roughly 10 million patients encounters annually. We have, I think, about 9,200 beds, of which approximately normal, in under normal circumstances, 1,300 of them are for critical care. And that's just the medical center alone. So by shifting resources in the Texas Medical Center, which is actually the name of the medical center in Houston, we could probably create additional almost 900 critical care beds if we need. And that can be divided into two phases, 400 for phase two, 500 for phase three. And what phase two means is that we're strained, but we can manage the increase in beds by diverting some resources. So like canceling elective surgeries, those kind of things. While phase three, it's our temporary surge capacity, but we're not really able to sustain for a significant amount of time. So at the peak of things, we probably were just about to hit phase three before everything started getting better. Fortunately, we didn't go into that phase, and now we're back to levels that we were seeing probably early April before all the rising started.
Malin, I realize you kind of dove right in there. I know specifically what you do, but I guess for someone listening, they might just be like, wow, that's a lot of information. I think we all in 2020 know more about hospital beds and ventilators availability. I know in London where I live, we opened up a whole new hospital, but I'm still interested in the fact that you had so many specific details. So we have a lot to cover, but I realized I didn't really specifically ask, like, what is it that you do and why do you have all these numbers so quickly available to you?
Well, I'm a nephrologist. For those of you that might not know what that is, I'm a physician specialized in treating disorders related to the kidneys, hypertension, which is high blood pressure, and electrolyte imbalances. I work in an academic setting for the Baylor College of Medicine, which is here located in Houston, and I work in a few of the affiliated hospitals. My clinical duties include seeing patients that are in the hospital setting, the clinic setting, and also patients that are on maintenance dialysis. I have some administrative duties where I serve as the associate program director for our nephrology fellowship training program. And also I'm the inpatient dialysis director for one of our affiliated hospitals. I'm also an educator where I supervise teaching services, primarily in nephrology, but I also do a little in general internal medicine. And lastly, I also give lectures to all levels of trainees and colleagues.
Right. So medical professional, we got to talk to Neil, our mutual friend, last year. Mm-hmm. Well, not last year specifically, but
earlier beginning. This year, right?
Yeah, exactly. Gosh, it feels like ages.
It's been forever.
Yeah. Neil gave us a breakdown of what was going on in New York at the time. Neil's an ER doc, but I still feel inclined to ask you this question because, you know, I'm so far removed from a hospital setting on a daily basis. And the question is just, you know, what's the latest at the hospital? We've been in a pandemic for the majority of 2020, and I don't think many of us are paying as close attention to it anymore. Feels like the moment sort of passed us, but it's still really prescient in everything. So yeah, what's the latest at the hospital?
So good question, I guess. The experiences in New York and Houston are quite different. I think the experience in New York, they didn't have any time to prepare. They were hit pretty hard. And fortunately in Houston, even though we had time to prepare and everything, we did hit a rough patch. But luckily, since probably mid-July, we've been seeing a continued improvement in the number of cases. And since maybe August, our hospitals are starting to have less and less patients in them. Right now, we're in probably a relaxed state, but I'm cautiously nervous with flu season right around the corner. Actually, it's probably started already. And then now we have schools and businesses and sporting events starting to open up. So we've just got to be careful here.
Basically, I realize that nephrology is not a discipline that's going to put you on the front lines of the COVID-19 fight, but you still end up going to a hospital pretty regularly. And I'm curious what it's like in the hospital, because from what I remember at the beginning and watching videos online and you know, the NHS in the UK had a really big push on just the sort of sacrifice healthcare providers were doing. Is everybody kitted out in PPE the whole time? Is it like, are you on a shortage? Like, what's going on with your daily experience?
Yes, you're correct. I'm not directly on the front line. I agree with you. It's more emergency medicine and critical care medicine, and also all the direct nursing care that goes there. So my heart really goes out to them. I think from our experience, at one point, the intensive care doctors at Baylor were working almost, nearly 150%. That meant including weekends. They wouldn't get their break weeks off. And I doubt they saw any significant rise in their pay for that. In fact, I know Baylor-wide, we all had a cut in our retirement contributions for about 90 days because they lost a lot of revenue. That being said, I have treated many hospitalized COVID patients. COVID-19, you can say either directly or indirectly, can cause what we call acute kidney injury. So it can cause kidney failure in up to almost 50% of the patients. As a nephrologist, I usually provide consultative care. And so we kind of consult with the primary team. So this way, my colleagues and I were really able to adapt our strategies. So sometimes we would get our histories or rely on the examination from the primary team, and then provide our management indirectly without significantly affecting patient care. Mostly these strategies were used to reduce significant PPE consumption. Initially during the panic, I think we had so much PPE that was just going missing in the hospitals, so we really had to start regulating their use. And also in the beginning, I think we found that what appropriate PPE was very confusing. We knew that COVID can be transmitted by contact means, so we started wearing gowns and surgical masks, but we weren't really sure how much it was airborne. So N95s were reserved for prolonged exposure or high-risk exposure. We found that the hospital started adapting and finding ways to reuse N95 masks, so they would sterilize them between uses and then send them back to the same provider. We also regularly started wearing eye protection later on. And at this time, I would say whenever I go out into the hospital area to see patients, I'm always wearing some kind of eye protection, and I'm always wearing a surgical mask. And myself, I would wear an N95 under the surgical mask and kind of wear it throughout the whole time I'm seeing patients.
Is there enough to go around now?
Fortunately, with these measures, and we also had a lot of ramped up production, I think right now we have adequate PPE supply. This is one of the reasons, I think, that we are slower in reopening hospitals, not allowing visitors as much. The more clinic visits you have, the more use of PPE we'll have. So a lot of our visits have converted into what we call tele-nephrology, or doing visits over virtual means. Either we'll use telephone or really starting to prefer more video visits.
And what about your patients? Like, specifically people that you've interacted with, have you had any run-ins? Like, I imagine people are coming in for dialysis, and what that means is that they are going into a hospital or they're going into some sort of clinic with other people, and it might be nicer for them to be isolated. So, I mean, have you had any run-ins, or do you know of anything?
So in addition to seeing hospitalized patients when they have kidney failure or injury, I have like a fairly big panel of patients that I kind of follow regularly. Even without COVID, they already have a higher risk of dying over time. I noticed probably during the peak of COVID, every few days I would hear one of my patients passed away, sometimes even from something else. So I look forward to seeing my patients, and over time I often get to know them well, and so this has been kind of hard for me. Sometimes I would hear that a patient just didn't show up for my clinic, or I couldn't contact them when I was trying to do a virtual visit. And later, when trying to dig into why, I would find out from a family member that they had passed.
Well, I'm just kind of curious, like, have we gotten any better at treating this? I remember ventilators were the thing we talked about for ages, and, you know, GM was making them, and we were trying to get everybody a ventilator, but death tolls are still pretty crazy. What were we doing before, and what are we doing now? Like, what's the trend in,
okay,
treatment?
I definitely think we have gotten better at treating this. We are rapidly learning more and more about this disease. There's countless journal articles, and they're churning them out, I would say. Sometimes you'll see some redactions, like you probably have heard of some of the major journal articles. One or two of them had been redacted due to not being able to really verify the data. That being said, we have learned a lot. One thing we know is that COVID-19 increases risk of blood clots, and these blood clots can propagate to any of the smaller vessels and can block off blood flow to any of your organs. So we're regularly using blood thinners to reduce the risk of these. The other thing we learned, as you mentioned, the ventilators, initially we thought that was the mainstay of treating these respiratory failure. Usually, when we have pneumonia from, let's say, the flu or bacterial pneumonia, and it's pretty severe, placing these patients on ventilators really gives their body a rest and supports their lungs and gives the patients a chance to recover. I can call this invasive ventilation, since we really need to insert a breathing tube to help them do that. With COVID-19, we're learning that this early lung support with invasive ventilation has not really helped. It said that when we can provide what we call non-invasive ventilation, or support the patients with just high doses of oxygen therapy through what we call a nasal cannula or a face mask, as long as that's feasible and that works, we're finding patients have a better chance of recovering from that. And when they do get what we call intubated, or have the tube placed in and put on the ventilator, the chances of making it out get lower and lower. We've learned that steroids seem to have some help to reduce all the inflammation that's going on, which is really what's affecting the lungs. The jury's still out on this antiviral that people might have heard about, remdesivir, made by Gilead. We think they have some effect, but we can't give it to all patients, especially many of my patients that I see. If they have significant kidney failure, it's contraindicated, meaning not recommended for use. We've also learned what things are harmful in treating this or may not have any effect. There was a lot of press about hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine, and the data right now suggests that it doesn't really help and may actually increase the toxicity.
It's funny that that's like a political statement. it shouldn't be a political statement, but it is entirely that. Sorry, I cut you off there.
No worries. I can't give you really an exact data on how much we've improved because the data that we have has a lot of pitfalls. Initially, when this early wave or first wave occurred, testing was not very easy to get, and all the tests were plagued with inaccuracies. So at that time, I don't know if we really caught the mild or what we call asymptomatic, meaning no symptoms cases. And now we're capturing a lot more tests. There's much more widespread testing for patients that have symptoms and come for testing. And then for many places, like because of school openings or sport teams and everything, they're just regularly checking for monitoring. And so it's going to be very hard to find out how much all this stuff is really helping.
It's like there's a massive amount of stuff we can do, but it doesn't seem like there's any silver bullet. And I think that's mm-hmm. what people are hoping for. So here's my hopeful question for you. And that's just, how long do you think we'll be handling all this stuff? I guess in your general opinion as a healthcare provider, do you think we'll be able to get through this in the next couple of months?
Unfortunately, I think the virus is too far spread and it's pretty contagious. So I think we're going to be dealing with this virus for a while until we come up with a much better treatment strategy, like a medication maybe that kills a virus faster or a really effective vaccine. I think we're going to be having to handle with this disease for a while.
So I remember at the beginning of all this, we were kind of told that masks were basically only for healthcare providers, like the homemade mask wasn't really a thing. And we weren't necessarily encouraged to desperately wear masks, but it was like, hey, that's a good idea. I know that a lot of people in London didn't actively wear masks, but generally speaking, now that's just the norm. Like walking around in London, walking around in Chicago, where I happen to be right now, there's masks everywhere. So I'm wondering, like, what are the best safety precautions that we can take? Is it as simple as just, okay, fine, everybody just wear a mask. It's going to be so much better if you just put a mask on, or is it more complicated than that?
Bottom line answer for that is just to be smart, cognizant. If we want to completely eliminate risk, then just stay home. You can't really do anything. And I don't believe that's feasible. So we just have to be aware of our risks. And I can tell you a little bit more about that. I want to stress, just because you can wear a mask doesn't mean you're going to be protected. A patient with COVID who is not wearing a mask is a high risk to you, even if you're wearing a mask. That same patient, if he or she is wearing a mask, it reduces the risk of spreading to you, even if you don't wear a mask. And when both individuals are wearing a mask, that really significantly lowers the risk. What's also important is that these masks are worn consistently and appropriately. I think every single day I see so many people wear them incorrectly or are frequently taking them off, just touching the mask on the outside and touching your face, scratching your nose or rubbing your eyes can reduce the effectiveness. You also have to wash your hands frequently, especially after handling a mask. And I'll stress that one too. Frequent hand washing is critical. Think about just the number of surfaces that come into contact with so many individuals. It has been shown that maybe the surfaces are not a significant way that coronavirus is spreading right now, but I still think this is really important to do, especially with the flu virus coming around too. Lastly, I think you also have to think about your location that you're in. If something's heavily populated or poorly ventilated, these areas are the highest risk. This is why restaurants and bars can be particularly risky, because you also have to take off your mask to eat and drink. I think you can lower that risk by outdoor dining and drinking. Just have to be careful and see how well people can physically distance. Public transport or air travel, this can also increase risk, even if you're wearing a mask. This is all really due to the limited ability to physically distance and the decreased ventilation on a flight, let's say. I think the travel companies are really working hard and are adapting, improving disinfection measures. So hopefully this becomes safer over time. I personally would not take a flight or go anywhere unless absolutely necessary right now. I think we're fatigued from virtual everything. I'm so tired of Zoom. I miss socializing. And, you know, humans, we're social creatures. So I think if I were to give recommendation to our listeners, I would say we need to relax and take the risks gradually. Businesses have been doing really well and adapting to decrease the risk as much as possible. I suggest something like opening up a little bit at a time. Additionally, we can also do like smaller gatherings where you can really sit 6 or more feet apart and outside. So these kind of things can really help.
So Mullen, you've outlined like just an enormous amount of information of things we got to be doing, masks and distance and all the same old, kind of feels like we've been living a version of it the entire year. I have never used the word social distancing as much as I've used it in 2020. I mean, I have to ask, like, will a vaccine really save us? Like, is it a panacea in that kind of way? I find that to be like this glimmer of hope, this North Star that we're all aiming for. But I also sort of wonder, like, is it just impossible for that to be a thing that actually helps us all? Or is it just going to be a kind of a filter mechanism for 70% of us will be fine, but then there's still like a really big population that's going to suffer from this?
I say it really depends. So first thing to consider is how likely will we be able to come up with a vaccine? And I'm cautiously optimistic for this one. But think about HIV/AIDS. At the time we discovered the pandemic or epidemic from HIV/AIDS, we strongly believed that we would be able to find a vaccine for this virus. I think there's like videos of the president saying we'll have a vaccine in 1 or 2 years, but yet we still don't have a vaccine for this virus. Luckily, we do have medications that can really control the infection very well. As for coronaviruses, there are at least 7 known coronaviruses that can infect humans. The SARS coronavirus 2, which is the one that causes COVID-19. That's the most recent one. The first 4, you probably never even heard of, and I don't even remember the names, but they are very common and infect people around the world, and you basically just get like a flu or flu-like illness. Then we have the more recent ones that have been publicized. So MERS, which is the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or SARS, the Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. So those are the 6, plus COVID-19 being 7. We still don't have any vaccinations for them. The good thing is that there has been a lot of ongoing research for developing vaccines against any coronavirus, and hopefully we can adapt a lot of that to the SARS coronavirus too. So let's say all of that research and the current promising results that these little studies have shown us do help us create a vaccine. So then what? Well, then we need to consider its effectiveness. As many people know, the annual flu vaccine, its effectiveness is so variable. Since we kind of take an educated guess on how the flu virus is going to mutate and then try to make the vaccine towards that. On the other hand, the poliovirus, that vaccine is very effective. I think 99% effective. Then we also have to consider how long immunity will last once you get that vaccine. And this could also be based on how much the coronavirus mutates. So if it's like the flu virus, we might need a vaccine every year. And we might have to guess on it too. But if it's more of a slowly mutating one, or if we can find a vaccine to a part of the virus that doesn't mutate, then we might be better off. We also have to consider the production and distribution of vaccines. This is going to take time. So even if we can get a vaccine by the end of the year, we're going to have to wait for some time before this. And lastly, hopefully there is none, but we have to consider side effects. We can test the vaccine on the 1,000 people or so in the study before the FDA approves it and it's out. At that time, we might just see minimal side effects on most people. But when it goes public and a lot of people start getting it, we could unmask some rarer side effects. If it's a mild effect, then probably doesn't concern us too much. But if it's severe, then it could really be troublesome and might have to go back to the drawing board. So bottom line, I think the vaccine is going to be a huge step towards winning against the coronavirus. But we really have to be cautious with our optimism here.
I guess, can I ask then, like, given the, I'm not going to say bleak outlook, I'm just going to say a distant outlook of a normality. And I know like 2 week breaks from your friends because they took a flight kind of thing. Today, right now, how nervous are you working in healthcare?
I would say early on, I was quite nervous. I think a lot of physicians, myself included, really wanted to just go straight all out with our personal protective equipment. I wanted to wear an N95 until we knew more about this. I wanted to wear the eye protection and the gowns. Because of the fears that all of this is going to run out, all hospitals, appropriately so, quite restricted that. And I remember seeing like online posts that some physicians were like, I want to wear a mask all day, but we were told that this would create panic and we're told not to wear them. Luckily, as we have learned more and more, our hospitals were very quick to adapt. And now I feel pretty well protected in the hospital. I would say maybe even safer in the hospital than I'm in a public setting. And I'll also add, like from all of my colleagues and everything, we really don't have major outbreaks within healthcare providers. If anyone's really getting it, they're usually getting in the community and everyone's being pretty good at distancing and everything. So we're not really seeing major outbreaks spreading between coworkers.
All right. Well, I have the last couple of questions. The first one is just a bit of a crystal ball question. Not that the pandemic's going to end on December 31st. So this is a strange question, but what are you hopeful for in 2021? It's a semi-arbitrary date. If you look at how a coronavirus does not follow any sort of Gregorian calendar or anything like that, but still feel like 2021 will be maybe hopefully potentially touch wood, the start of something new for us. So what are you hopeful for?
I'm really looking forward to 2021 and I'm still very nervous overall. We still have a couple of months to go in 2020. We really don't know how flu season is going to impact COVID-19. The Spanish flu infected almost a third of the world's population and probably killed about 50 million people. This one occurred over waves. I think there were 4 waves over 2 years. So I'm just hopeful that we've learned some lessons from all of that, and the advances in medicine, our global health, and all this stuff is going to help us. So hopefully 2021 is better than 2020. I'm just going to be a little cautious right now.
Cautiously optimistic. Mullen, the last bit here, this episode, I know we're recording it before, but it'll be released on the Monday before we all usually would go in to vote in person. Ideally, most of the Americans have already voted by mail or early or something, but I imagine there's still going to be a smattering of people going in the next day. So any doctor-related advice that you like to tell people who are still going to hit a polling station up tomorrow?
I would definitely go vote, one. I think it's going to be very important for shaping our country's future. And I think there are safe ways to do it. I think if we follow some of the things that we talked about earlier, wearing your mask and sanitizing your hands and monitoring the distancing between people, I think we can really do this in a safe manner.
Yeah, I'm hopeful people are careful and safe if they're going in and voting. The common thread for these episodes since the start of this season and up until now have just been making sure that you're registered and you can get in. At this stage, it would be a bit late to tell you to register, but if you haven't voted and you can, I recommend doing it in as safe a way as possible. And Mullen, thank you so much for taking some time out. I know you're really busy. I know it's 9 o'clock in the evening. I'll leave you to it. And thank you for all the hard work you're doing and for helping everybody out. And I think the advice you gave us is like a good stern reminder that we're not over this particular mountain just yet.
Yeah, thanks, Abhishek. It was fun doing this. And I think if we as a community follow some of these guidelines, we can definitely overcome this. It won't be easy, but I definitely think we can make it through.
Mullen was going to share some numbers across the world for this episode, but given how rapidly things change, I thought I would do that here. At the time of writing this, there were 41.4 million cases of COVID-19 with 1.13 million deaths. In the US alone, there are over 220,000 deaths with over 60,000 cases that were just today. And in the UK, where I live, we have an astounding 26,000 cases yesterday, with a death toll of nearly 44,000. We also recorded this before the side effects of many vaccines in phase 3 trials were found. So that cautious optimism that Mullen mentioned might just be caution. As today is the last day before the US election, and I know that some of you haven't voted yet, I'm going to remind you what we said at the end of our conversation. Please be safe, wear a mask, sanitize your hands, practice social distancing. And when you're voting, think about the response you've seen in COVID-19 from people you voted for. Did they take it seriously? Did they call it fake news? Did they listen to science? Or did they think, well, this is no big deal? And hopefully, if you've listened to this after Election Day, all is well, and the US/world hasn't completely imploded. Fingers crossed.
That's it for today's story. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, you can subscribe to get the latest updates anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment and you're feeling generous, please leave a review. I'd really appreciate it, and it helps me understand how to make this show even better. For more info on me and this concept, you can visit our website at onesimplequestion.co. One Simple Question is hosted by me, Abhishek Lahoti. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you tune in again soon, and bye for now.